你好 and welcome to Mandarin Pod, 中文特高级。I'm your host, 天周,周天。Mandarin Pod is a conversational Chinese language learning podcast for advanced Mandarin learners. In this podcast, we'll be speaking exclusively in Mandarin about topics like Chinese culture and society. This is a great way to practice your listening and learn something new. This podcast is brought to you by Sishu Mandarin, Sishu 中文。Sishu Mandarin is a Chinese language school based in New York City. We provide both in-person and online classes for individuals, groups, and corporate clients. Click the link in our bio for more information. On this episode, we have a special guest, Evelyn Chow. Evelyn will share stories from the past and present about the Chinese immigrants in America. We'll also talk about the challenges and discrimination early Chinese immigrants faced and what the social landscape looks like for today's Asian American community.Evelyn Chow is a freelance journalist who often writes about China and Chinatowns across America. Her stories have appeared in the New York Times, BBC, Foreign Policy, and many other major media outlets. She's also the author of Newbie, The Real Chinese You Were Never Taught in School. Newbie will teach you the colorful vernacular phrases Chinese people use every day. This book teaches you how to flirt, date, fight, and party.You will also learn all the swear words you will ever need to know. You can follow her on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. We'll share all her contact information in the show notes. Also, just a heads up, our conversation was recorded in English, so you'll be completely fine listening to this episode, even if you don't speak Chinese at all. 你好 Evelyn. Thank you for coming to our show. It's so great to have you here with us today. And happy Chinese New Year.
Oh, 谢谢. Happy Chinese New Year to you too.
All right. So speaking of Chinese New Year, how did you celebrate your Chinese New Year?
So I actually, this maybe is getting ahead of what you're asking, but I grew up in an area without any Asian people, actually.
Okay.
So I grew up not celebrating Chinese New Year at all. It's very
sad. That's fine. So you didn't really celebrate this year?
Well, this year because of COVID.
COVID, yeah.
Not really. But yeah. Normally, you know, sometimes I'll go to Manhattan Chinatown and watch the parade, things like that. Or go to like dumpling parties at friends' places. So I look forward to doing things like that once everything gets back to normal.
I didn't celebrate the New Year as well.So my wife and I had McDonald's for the Chinese New Year Eve dinner. So you just mentioned that you grew up in a place where there's very few Asian Americans or Chinese people around. So where were you born?
Sure. So I was born in Maryland. Mm-hmm. And I grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland. I'm not sure how well known it is. The town's called Cambridge, population like 10,000.It's an interesting area. The demographics are about 50% Black and 50% white. And it's sort of Southern and sort of Northern because it's in Maryland. So it just gave me a really interesting perspective on life.
And that's also where you grew up?
Yes. Okay. I was born and grew up there.
All right. Why do you think your parents chose that place in the first place?
So my parents are from Taiwan. Mm-hmm.And my father immigrated in the 1970s as a grad student in physics. So that was a time period when a ton of grad students from Taiwan were coming in physics and math and engineering because of a lot of different factors going on both in Taiwan and in the U.S. But the short answer on the U.S. side is that the 1965 Immigration Act,passed that opened up immigration from Asia. And also at the same time, there was a huge need for math and science and engineering talent.
But you didn't choose physics as your major in college, right? Did you?
No, not at all.
So what was your major in college?
I studied in English. I can't tell you anything about my dad's physics work at all. I studied English. I was like a kid who always loved to read and write, and I still have all these notebooks that I, you know, kept when I was little, writing stories or diaries about my day and things like that.
Okay.
I grew up probably when I was very young. I think I did speak Chinese with my parents.
Okay.
But then once I started going to school, you know, at the age of like 4 or something, so many Chinese Americans, I'm sure, will tell the same story. But
right.
It became like whenever my parents spoke to me in Chinese, I would always just answer in English. And because they spoke English well,they just kind of switched over too. So I probably lost, you know, all the Chinese I spoke as a child. But then actually in college, I studied Chinese there. And that was actually a funny Chinese class because probably most of the students in it were Taiwanese Americans.
So your parents never kind of push you or force you to study Chinese? They never sent you to like a Chinese Saturday school or something like that?
So we were geographically very far from parts of Maryland that had a large Chinese community. Mm-hmm. So there were no Chinese schools or anything like that nearby. Mm-hmm. But I did go to there was like a summer camp nearby that was for Chinese Americans, and we like sang songs in Chinese and things like that. So I studied a teeny bit of Chinese through that. And also growing up, we would visit Taiwan every other summer, something like that, for about a month. I still somehow managed not to pick up much Chinese as a kid in mm-hmm. Taiwan.
That's fine. Okay. And you said your major in college was English. And I'm just curious why you chose to be a journalist.
Well, I've just always loved to read, and I always loved to tell people about things that are going on. I guess you could say I kind of love gossip.
Okay.
And as a journalist, you just get to report about things that are happening. So the way I got into it was, I majored in English in college. And then in 2006, I moved to Beijing.
Right.
And
that's right after your college year?
Well, I graduated a few years earlier.
Okay.
So before that, I worked at a book publishing company in New York, eventually moved to Beijing and worked at a business magazine there.
So when you went to Beijing, did you know that you're going to be like a journalist at Beijing? Was that something that you were looking for?
Oh, no, not at all. Well, I will say, actually, one reason I left my book publishing job in New York was that I figured out while I was there that I didn't really love being an editor that much. And there were actually very few opportunities to do any writing or even any editing, actually. It turned out that kind of work was more like being a project manager, more or less. So I did know when I went to Beijing that I wanted to write more, but I didn't really know how that would happen. I just moved to Beijing because it was just like a very interesting time to move there. I had friends who were there. It was before the Olympics. So, you know, I'm sure, you know, like that was just a very exciting time to be in Beijing. And then it was, it was kind of a period when like if you spoke English, you could get like a great job almost anywhere. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but this is all to say that I didn't really have journalism experience, and yet I got hired at a business magazine.
Right. I read one of your articles about how your working experience in Beijing, and you were like promoted. You were being promoted like really quickly. And so what was it like working and living in Beijing as a foreign person?
It was amazing. I mean, I guess as a Chinese American, I had a slightly different experience because I could walk around and eat in restaurants and things like that and and people would not necessarily know I was foreign.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Of course, at the same time, I am American. So, you know, there were things that seemed very strange and different to me. And so I also simultaneously experienced things as a foreigner. But, you know, there would be like little things like if I'd be at a party and standing near like two white guys and, you know, they would assume that I couldn't understand them and I would get to eavesdrop on what they were saying and, you know, little moments like that that were interesting.
I'm just curious, like when you were in China, your interest, like most of your writings and your journalism is mostly about business, or I would say they're business related, right?
Yeah, it just happened that the job that I heard about and ended up getting hired at was a business publication. But before then, I couldn't have said that I had any particular interest in business.
Right.
But then, you know, once I was there, it was obviously incredibly fascinating because of the fact that China was developing so fast in the world of business at that time.
The reason that I ask is because now I know you have another interest, which is your interest in the Chinatown history. Like, what did you realize that you have this strong interest in learning about the Chinese American immigrants and the history of Chinatowns?
This is like I could talk for like 3 hours about I don't think
I got time. I don't know if you have time.
I don't even think I would like actually even like land on the answer after talking for 3 hours because there's just so many different factors. But, you know, growing up in an area without any Asian people, like I became very fascinated by, you know, some like growing up when we would go to, like I visited San Francisco once when I was in middle school and like maybe like 12 or 13 or something. And I remember we went through to Chinatown and it was just so, you know, it was like, oh, wow, like, what is this? You know, what, like, why is this here?
So it seemed foreign to you.
yeah, exactly. And then, you know, it's also just, even though I studied English in school, I think now if I could go back in time, I would probably study history, because I've come to realize over time that I'm really fascinated in history. And the history of Chinatown is just so amazing, just as a part of U.S. and world history. Like, it dates back to the 1850s, 1860s,
right?
At least in New York, and then mm-hmm. the West Coast is even older.
Yeah, it gives a very interesting angle to look at the history of America.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Actually, that's why I want to talk about more about the Chinese Americans, and particularly the Taishanese. Because if you really look into the immigrants of the early Chinese Americans, most of them, they were coming from Taishan. So why is that?
Oh my gosh. So this is another thing where I feel like...
Another 3 hours.
Well, first I should give the caveat that if anyone is like listening to this and is going to like write an academic paper or anything like that, like fact check everything I say, because I might not, you know, I might not get every single like mm-hmm. little detail right. But just based on past research and what I can remember, academics would say that the reason people emigrate is that there's like quote unquote push and pull factors. Mm-hmm. So there were things going on in the US and also things going on in China that like caused all these people to leave. But so on the Chinese side, in Taishan in particular, they just experienced so many disasters like during that time period leading up to the gold rush in the US. So, you know, they're like famine, like warlordism. I think there was like maybe more than one really severe drought. There was like a financial crisis among like British banks that, you know, then like affected the money situation throughout, I think, all of Guangzhou. There are all these, you know, there was just like a lot of reasons to leave Taishan and go somewhere else to make money. And then in the US, you had the gold rush going right. on. That's just one tiny little part of why. Right.
And Taishan is so close to the coast, so they can just take the ship and and travel to the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that both Taishan and Fujian is like just the fact that they're close to the coast and have right. ports. That's just even the very idea of emigrating, it just obviously is going to pop into your head more when you live near a coast. So.
And when the Taishanese people, they arrive in the U.S., most of them, they couldn't be like a lawyer or like an engineer. So what were the jobs they were doing back then?
Right. So at this time, there was very little opportunity for Chinese in America. I mean, you do have throughout, dating very far back in American history to the earliest days, you do have like Chinese diplomats going back and forth and like people with money. And, you know, there's like Chinese people are appearing throughout U.S. history. But yes, for this particular demographic of unskilled labor, basically, coming to the U.S. It was, you know, they didn't speak English most of the time, and there was a lot of, they were just viewed as very foreign, too. This was the time period when everyone had to have the, you know, the queue, right. the mm-hmm. long ponytail by law. And so between that and the foreign language and, like, just racism, viewed as so different and so alien and so strange. So, well, it would take me another 3 hours to talk about, you know, xenophobia and racism. But yeah, there were very few opportunities for work besides like manual labor, like the railroads and mining and things like that.
So lots of the Chinese immigrants, early Chinese immigrants, they were either railroad builders or they go into the laundry business. And I wonder why they chose to go to the laundry business. Because I've seen you have some articles about some laundromats that were in Chinatown and that are going to close, unfortunately. So I just wonder why there are so many Chinese people choose to start laundry business.
So many factors, once again. But the shortest answer is that it's just like an easy business to go into. Like, if you don't speak English, it's work that you can still do. It requires very little startup capital. So I'm slightly exaggerating, but all you really need to do is be able to afford to buy a wooden washboard and uh-huh. you can set up shop. I think there are other factors too. I think it was an established industry in Hong Kong. So there was kind of like that pattern right. already of like kind of like knowing about how this worked. And then also there was, after the gold rush period, there was a lot of anti-Chinese xenophobia because there was like an economic downturn. A lot of like white Irish and other white workers wages were getting pushed down. A ton of economic reasons. They were pushed. So Chinese laborers were pushed out of basically the jobs that were considered desirable by other men, mm-hmm. With things like mining. I don't know what else. I imagine things like construction. you know, at the time, the American West was being built largely by men. So there was a great need for the work that quote unquote women do. So there was just kind of this market opportunity to supply the service that was missing.
They saw the opportunity, right? How do you do your laundry nowadays?
So I live in a small New York apartment, like most people in New York, and I do my laundry at the laundromat across the street. But, you know, it's always interesting to me to go do my laundry there because the family that runs it is, they're all immigrants from Mexico. Okay. So it's really interesting to me to think about these like new waves of immigration and that are like coming in. And another one is I go to a Korean owned dry cleaner too, right, to do my dry cleaning. And so that's very fascinating to me too, that the total Chinese laundry period was from like just after the gold rush to all the way up to like pretty recently, like 1960s, 70s. And then nowadays, if you ask kind of like older Chinese Americans who grew up in laundry families, some of them will say like, oh, now it's like all these Korean owned dry cleaners that started to pop up in the 80s. So
right. Really, I heard like 40% of the dry cleaners in New York City are run by the Koreans.
Oh, 40%. Really? I didn't know that.
Right. Oh, I read somewhere. I don't quite remember. And actually, there's this laundromat I used to go a lot. It was owned by Taiwanese people. And there's a convenience store next to it that is owned by Taiwanese people as well. I didn't notice that before because I picked up some Cantonese from the owners. And I used those Cantonese to talk to other Cantonese-speaking people and they didn't understand me. Then I later found out I wasn't really speaking Cantonese. I was speaking Taishanese. Cantonese with accent. So that's how I found out. I was like, I was living in a Taishanese community.
Yeah,
in Brooklyn.
Fascinating.
Right, in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. Another very interesting fact that I write in one of your articles is the laundromat owners, they use craft paper to pack clothes. I wonder why. They're not using plastic bags.
Yeah.
I just couldn't figure it out.
The period when like the whole, when the ethnic niche of like the Chinese run hand laundry was being established, that was like, that was before plastic bags really
were
being mass produced. So in the old days, everything was just wrapped in paper and string. Like when you bought things from a store too, I think it would be wrapped in paper and string. And then, some of these old last holdout laundries that I've written about, I think they just, you know, wanted to hang on to the old ways of doing things. So they just,
and it's also more environmental friendly, I guess.
Right. Yeah. That's the funny thing is now I could see like everyone switching back to craft paper and string.
There's just so many fun facts. Another thing is I noticed like there are so many Chinese people back then in the 50s and the 60s, they were being called Charlie. And it was pretty offensive. I didn't know that.
Right. So it's very interesting because a lot of things that are considered offensive and things that are considered flattering, it just depends on kind of the age of the person you're talking to and like what kind of environment they grew up in the U.S., you know. So calling Chinese people Charlie, this came from a fictional Chinese detective character named Charlie Chan. I don't remember what year these novels were first published. I want to say the 1930s, but I'm not really sure. So during that time period, the kind of like more stereotypical portrayal of Chinese men was the Fu Manchu idea, who was like the evil villain. And if I could show an image of it, you would like immediately recognize it, probably like, oh, that image. So there were very negative portrayals of Chinese men in, you know, movies and pop culture. And then dating back to like connecting with the laundryman stereotypes too. There were, you know, Chinatowns in general were stereotyped as like these criminal places where like, you know, people were up to no good. When the Charlie Chan stereotype arose, that was actually considered progress because this was a very positive portrayal of a Chinese man. He was the hero in all these novels. He was very smart. He solved all these crimes and he talked a lot about like, you know, his like Chinese values. And so at the time, I think probably Chinese people really celebrated the fact that suddenly this was like the new image of Chinese in media that everyone thought of.
So the Chinese people back then, they were okay with Charlie.
Well, I don't really know what they thought. Okay. I mean, I will also add that Charlie was played in movies, usually by a white man who had like makeup on his eyes to look Chinese and, uh-huh. and spoke with like a fake Chinese accent. So it was like horribly offensive, totally. But it was certainly better than being portrayed as the evil Fu Manchu villain.
Of course.
I imagine people kind of welcomed him sort of at the time. But then of course, over time, you know,
right.
progressed and people began to resent like that new stereotype as well.
And people nowadays, they don't, you know, really know the negative connotation behind the name Charlie, I guess.
Yeah, right. It's sort of like now, very few people just period of, you know, just across the board know who Charlie Chan was. But, you know, so, once upon a time, he was like, you know, everyone would have seen the movies and read the novels featuring him.
So it would be okay for a Chinese parent to name their child Charlie now.
Oh, yeah. I can definitely think of a few Chinese Charlies, actually. Charlie. So, yeah.
You know, I was one of them. Because when I was studying English back in China, when I was little, my English teacher gave me this name, which is Charlie. I never used it. That was like my first official English name.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
That's why the Charlie question. And you were just mentioning about the evil side of the Chinatown. There's another word I didn't know before, which is Kai Doi. It's a Taishanese word. I actually use that word to some of my Taishanese friends. They all laugh about it.
Oh, really?
So what is this word exactly, Kai Doi?
Right. So I'm sure Taishanese people will cringe at my pronunciation, but I think Kai Doi, you know, I don't actually speak Taishanese, so somebody please correct me. But I was told that it meant bad boy, basically. And I'll just explain the article that you probably read. So I met a bunch of guys in their 70s and 80s who grew up in Chinatown during the 1950s and 60s. And Chinatown was very different then. It was probably only like, I don't know, 5,000, maybe 7,000 people. It was just Mott Street and then maybe like a 5-block stretch of Mott Street, maybe a little more. Everyone spoke Taishanese. And in fact, it was viewed, there was actually a lot of tension between the China-born and the American-born Chinese in the community. These people I met who were American-born, they spoke a lot about how they were always criticized for being too American, basically. But so anyway, this particular group of guys that I wrote about, they got called the Kai Doi because there's an American movie star named James Dean who was in a very famous movie. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, called Rebel Without a Cause. But in the 1950s, this was like the huge movie that like everyone saw and everyone idolized this person in the movie. So he was very rebellious. He wore a leather jacket. He like rode a motorcycle. And these guys said that they idolized James Dean and they kind of copied him. So I heard for example, I would hear from like women who had grown up around Chinatown back then that like their fathers told them not to date any of those guys because they were bad boys.
Okay. What I heard is the meaning of Kai Doi is worse than bad boy. I don't know. Yeah. I don't speak Taishanese because I cannot speak off for them.
I'm probably missing a lot of the nuances of the meaning too.
Is the Kai Doi like a triad?
So,
there
may have been some overlap in the usage of that term because it's very hard for me to tell because there were kind of like, there are these organizations in Chinatown that were called triads or gangs, but then sometimes they'd be called business associations. And it's kind of one of these things where like historically they were just associations, but they had to do a lot of things and like sort of over time, I think. Like the term gang kind of overlapped with what they were doing.
And some of them are even patriotic.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the other thing too, actually, is that during this period in America, there was like all this fear about youth gangs. And so just in general, you know, even outside of Chinatown, there was a lot of fear over all these young people running around together, forming gangs and that thinking like, oh, it's this huge crisis in the country right now. But then at the same time, it was also very normal to form social clubs and give it a name. And so, you know, sometimes these social clubs form and they would get called gangs. And it's like, it's unclear to me, you know, whether they were really gangs. And even if they were gangs, like what that means, are they doing criminal activity? Were they just
having
boys
fun?
Getting into trouble? You know, it's like, it's very, it's kind of depends on whose perspective you're looking.
There's so many like early Chinese immigrants who were Taishanese. And there are also a lot of people who are from Fujian.
Yes.
They not only came to the US, but also they arrived at other parts of the America? Like some people went to the Latin America. So were they having the same challenges as the Taiwanese people who were facing in America?
I guess, everyone faced different conditions in every country.
Were they welcome in other parts of America, such as like Jamaica, the country Jamaica?
Yeah, it's really hard to say. In Jamaica, Chinese first were brought also as laborers by, I think they were recruited by British shipping companies to come basically be indentured labor in a couple years, make money, and then go back home and get to be wealthy back home, or, you know, wealthier than you were. But then, of course, there was a lot of abuse in the system, and some people were basically kind of kidnapped, and there was like a wide range of experiences. At least from Chinese Jamaicans I've met who grew up there, a lot of the ones I've spoken to look back very fondly at their experiences there. You know, they first went to the Caribbean, not just Jamaica, but a lot of other countries as laborers. And then over time, because they had like village networks and sources of financing, you know, through family and back from China and just all these different reasons, they were able to kind of rise in society, and they formed like kind of like a merchant class. And actually, even now, the big stereotype of Chinese in Jamaica is that they're grocery store owners.
Right.
So they were, you know, they were like in the kind of the social and racial hierarchy, they were like lower than the white landowners and plantation owners. But they were also higher than, you know, the black laborers. So they were this in-between level of society. So it's, you know, so for some people it was a negative experience, and some it was a positive experience.
Right. But I think nowadays the Jamaican people, they have a friendlier attitude toward the Chinese people. Because I have some like Jamaican friends, they just love Chinese people. I don't know why.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what I heard. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'd love to hear more about that.
Right. Because I feel like the Chinese government is pouring money in building like infrastructures in Jamaica and some other parts in Latin America. That's probably how they change their view, or I don't know. Could be.
Yes. Yeah. There is that. I mean, there's also always a lot of fear about like, oh, is this actually a new form of colonialism? And
right,
so there's always
right,
like a
course.
Lot of debates around it.
Another thing that I don't think many people know, especially people who are from China or people who are not from America, United States, that is the bamboo seeding. And I didn't know that word before I came to the U.S. So could you tell us what bamboo seeding is?
Yeah, so this is not something I've really written about much. So I haven't like done a ton of research or anything like that into it. So there's an expression in English that's the glass ceiling. This is my first time trying to define it out loud. So I'm kind of like, what am I even saying? I guess it sort of means that there's kind of a invisible ceiling to how high you can rise. When women in the U.S. were entering the workforce, there was a lot of talk about the glass ceiling, like, oh, we're celebrating, you know, the fact that all these companies are now hiring women and they're allowed to be more than just secretaries and typists, but there's still a limit to how high they can rise. You know, there's still a limit to, like, men are not willing to have a woman as their boss, for example. So the bamboo ceiling is kind of that idea applied to Asian Americans. I guess a big thing worth mentioning is that there is a stereotype that Asians are very good workers and they work really hard and they're great for jobs like engineering and, you know, computer programming and things like that, but they're not good managers and not good at dealing with other people. And so they tend to not get promoted into management positions. I can't I can't really cite the stats that back that up, but this is just kind of the bare outlines of the debate. Mm-hmm. And actually I've read a book about some of this time period. And I think I remember it mentioning that there was like, I want to say the 60s was the time period. But there was like a lawsuit where a bunch of Chinese Americans, you know, sued their employers about this bamboo ceiling situation. Hmm. And some of the white managers expressed surprise to even hear that they want it to be promoted. You know, they were like, oh, like, yeah, like we thought Asians didn't want to have to be like managers, like they genuinely believed that these were like innate qualities of Chinese people. So there's still a lot of those kinds of stereotypes and ideas that are being worked through even today, and that still affect workplaces now. Right. Actually, one thing that I only recently learned is that some people explain some of this from the fact that during the 60s and 70s, a lot of Asian Americans entering the workforce were these immigrants from Taiwan who had come over, you know, in like math and science and engineering. That particular group of people, they grew up during the period in Taiwan called the White Terror. Mm-hmm. So basically under authoritarianism, when it was like very bad things would happen to you if you spoke up. And so everyone was taught like, you know, never complain, never like speak up. In some interviews I've read, at least that segment of people, they say that that was the reason they got stereotyped that way, because they had like been brought up with this idea that you shouldn't speak up. And so maybe they behave the same way in the workplace. But that said, there was also a lot of unjust stereotyping happening, like regardless of how people were behaving. So there's right. a lot going on.
So have you ever experienced the bamboo sitting work? Or
It's hard. I can't think of anything where that's happened, but it's hard for me to be able to say because I'm a freelancer.
Right.
And I choose to be a freelancer. So I haven't had that experience of trying to rise in like a corporate
right.
setting.
It varies, yeah. Depending yeah. on what industry you're in, I guess.
Yeah, but I'm sure it exists. You can just look at the statistics for, you know, how yeah. many Asian CEOs there are.
Right. I want to bring us back to today because we talk about lots of like history stuff. Because nowadays, because of COVID, I feel like the Asian Americans or the Chinese Americans are facing a lot of discrimination today. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know, like, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I've been pretty lucky. I mean, I did grow up in an area without Asian people, as I've mentioned. So I experienced a lot of things that I would not really call racism, but I would call like ignorance. Just people saying things to me that like looking back, I'm like, what? You know? But they're also kind of funny too. So like, for example, when I was little, like, I remember like sometimes I was like maybe 8 and like some older kids, so maybe like 10 or 11, you know, like they would stop me in the hallway and be like, oh, do you know Kung Fu? Like, do you know karate? I was like the first Asian person they'd seen in real life. And then I guess their primary experience of a Chinese American was watching like Bruce Lee movies and Kung Fu movies. So there were like things like that happened. In terms of things that were like real hostility, I can't really say I've personally experienced a lot of that kind of thing. I guess the broader thing I was going to say is that it's always been the case that the way Chinese Americans and Asian Americans in general are treated in the U.S., has always been tied to what relations between the two countries are like.
Right.
So, you know,
not necessarily China. It could be Korea, right? It could be
right?
North Korea,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
we all look like Asian. I mean, we are Asian, right? And people can right. tell the difference.
Yeah, yeah. So like in the 80s when
the
white
Vietnam
auto workers.
And, yeah, right, that's even earlier, right? The 60s yeah. or the 70s.
I was going to mention the killing of Vincent Chin, who was a Chinese American who was killed by auto workers in, I think it was Detroit, who thought he was Japanese. Huh. And, you know, at the time there was a lot of anger in that area at Japanese car companies because they were out competing American car companies. And so, you know, they were saying like, you're the reason we're losing our job, you know, things like that. And this guy ended up getting killed who wasn't even Japanese. I'm getting off topic here, but that's actually a lot of the reason the term Asian American exists, because like, you know, to acknowledge that we all have these similar experiences
right.
and need to mm-hmm. join up together to address them.
Yeah. So how has the form of discrimination changed over the years? Because right now we're still facing, I mean, the Asian Americans are still facing a lot of discriminations. I feel like it's less, it has become less, but it's still there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing that I find interesting is that historically, the image of Chinese was that they were very poor. And then so a lot of the negative stereotypes about them were tied to the overall poor treatment that poor people get anyway, right? So poor people always get blamed when like a crime happens. Everyone says like, oh, it must have been someone from that neighborhood who's responsible for these crimes that are happening in our wealthier neighborhood. So for a long time, like Chinatowns were stereotyped as being like dirty, poor places, the people there as being criminal. The few women that they saw there, the few Chinese women that were seen, there were a lot of prostitutes. And then also in movies, the portrayal of Asian women included a lot of like slave girls and things mm-hmm. like that. So there was this overall very negative image of Chinese. And then more recently, this new stereotype is emerging of Chinese being wealthy, that, you know, changed the treatment of probably most, you know, your average Chinese walking around, I guess, probably for the better. But then, you know, if your stereotype is wealthy, then that brings a lot of negative consequences too. So, right. You know, when inequality increases and people become angry at rich people, and then everyone looks at you and thinks you must be some rich Chinese who's buying up all the property in our city and causing real estate prices to go up.
Which is kind of true.
I know, right? Yeah. So I guess my point is just that there's like different stereotypes right. over time, but they all have downsides.
As a Chinese person, so what do you think that I can do to show other people, the non-Chinese people or even the haters, that we're friends, not enemies? Or maybe like for you, like you read stuff about Chinatown or stuff about Chinese culture. I think that's a great way to contribute.
To reduce the bias.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was actually going to lead up to saying like, well, I guess it's important to educate yourself. So first I was going to say, if I actually knew the answer to this, there would be no strife in the world and we would all be at peace forever and it'd be great. So there's no answer, but yeah, I do think it's really important to learn your history, learn the history of the people around you, and educate yourself. You know, for example, like thing that's getting talked about a lot more in the news lately is that the 1965 Immigration Act that led right. to so many Asians coming to the U.S., that was brought about by the civil rights movement. That's a reason it's important for, you know, newer immigrants to understand like what struggles happened before they got here. This is like a silly small story, but I'll just like throw out a tiny little example for that happened in my life. Was that I mentioned earlier that when I was little, like kids in my town would say like, "Oh, do you know Kung Fu?" Just because I was Asian. And so I grew up. My parents immigrated in the 70s, so I grew up having no idea who Bruce Lee was. So all I knew about Bruce Lee was that he was the reason that people were asking me if I knew Kung Fu. So I hated Bruce Lee growing up. But then later in life, you know, I actually learned a lot more about him. And I came to learn that he was actually a hero in like a lot of African-American communities. And his movies were marketed very heavily in Black neighborhoods. So that's part of why, you know, those kids were asking me about Kung Fu. You know, it doesn't make it like okay that, you know, you would look at someone and just stereotype them as, you know, doing as being one way just because of what they look like. But it just like changes my understanding of what that interaction was, right? Like as a little kid, I thought I was being harassed in some way. And now as an adult, I look back and I find that interaction really interesting because I know right. so much
people
more.
People are just curious, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's cool.
Right. Yeah. Now I think Bruce Lee is awesome. So it's great.
Yeah. So let me do some easier questions. So is there a movie or book? I mean, you mentioned some movies and books, but is there like a particular movie or book that you recommend if someone wants to learn more about the Chinese American history or Asian American history?
Sure. So I actually just earlier today was skimming in preparation for our talk, The Chinese in America by Iris Chang. It's kind of like a staple book that would get taught in a lot of like Asian American studies classes on college campuses. Although I have not actually ever taken an Asian American studies class. So that's probably why I do the journalism that I do, is this is my own form of teaching myself. More recently, a book I read pretty recently and really enjoyed was, it's by Helen Zia, Z-I-A, who is a very prominent Asian American activist. And now I'm forgetting what the book is called.
That's fine. We can look it up later.
Yeah, I'm trying to see it because it's actually on my bookshelf over there, but I don't. Anyway, I can. But it's about the whole period when the nationalists fled China and went to Taiwan and the U.S. And it follows four people experiences throughout that whole period. And it's amazing.
What's the movie called? A Crazy Crazy Rich Asians? That helped a lot of people. It's not like an artsy movie, but it's a movie that helped a lot of people understand Asian culture.
Yeah. Oh, actually, you know what? I'm only like three episodes in, so apologies if it turns out to be a terrible show, but I've been watching Warriors, which is a show on, what is it on? Is it HBO or Cinemax? I want to say it's Cinemax, but anyway, it's a series based on a Bruce Lee script.
Yeah, I should definitely
check
Glorious.
It out. It's set in San Francisco Chinatown during the period before, leading up to the Chinese, the passing of the Chinese Exclusion Act. So it's like very over the top and has like cartoony violence and things. So
that sounds interesting. I'll definitely check it out.
It's not like fully historical. Yeah, but it's really cool to just kind of get a sense of that time period.
And you forgot to mention your book, the newbie book.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Everyone cancel everything I said, but everyone should just read my book.
And I just mentioned the word newbie, and I think I should make this episode explicit. And so what's the story behind it? So why did you want to write about the book? It's such an interesting book. It's not like a conventional Chinese teaching book. So I really want to know, like, what's the motive behind it?
Right. So the story behind it is actually not that exciting. It's actually it's part of a series. My book agency is called Writer's House, and they represented a whole series of books throughout the 90s that were called like a curse word, basically, in all these different languages. So the Russian one was called Dermo. There's one called Merode. There's one called, there were like these slang / dirty words book for like Spanish, Japanese.
And you got a Chinese assignment.
Yeah, basically. So my agent noticed like, oh, these books that we published in the 90s still make money. We should do a Chinese.
So how did they find you? You were cursing out loud in Chinese?
Oh, no, a friend of mine happened to work at that agency. So she just told me that they were looking for proposals. And I wrote a proposal. And well, actually, she told me and I said, oh, yeah, I'm interested in writing a proposal. And then I didn't do anything. And then months later, she emailed me again and said, oh, you know, they're still looking for someone. Are you going to do this or not? And finally, I submitted a proposal and they liked it. It was a lot of fun to write because I was living in China at the time and it gave me an excuse to hang out with interesting people and ask them about interesting slang.
I think everybody who's listening now should check out the book. The book is called Newbie, and I'll put the name of the book in the show notes. It's a very, very interesting book.
Buy the book Newbie.
Okay, yeah, of course.
好了，以上就是我和 Evelyn Chow 的全部对话。如果你对 Evelyn 的书感兴趣，你可以在 Amazon 上找到她的书。如果你对她的文章感兴趣，你也可以在 Twitter 和 Instagram 上关注她。另外，我们的 show notes 里还有 Evelyn 给大家推荐的一些跟华人历史有关的书籍和影视作品。如果你喜欢我们的播客节目，不要忘记订阅或者给我们留个好评。我们的节目完全是独立制作，你的关注、分享和好评是对我们最大的帮助和鼓励。如果你想了解或者知道任何跟中国或者中国文化相关的东西，都可以联系我们。你可以在我们的 show notes 里找到联系我们的方式。如果你想了解到其他和中文相关的知识，也可以去我们的网站 sishumandarin.com 看看。我们的网站上有许多免费的中文学习资源。我是周天，我们下期再见。